session number 8282, reel 3.
Mr. Dufall, reel 3.
Yes, we got the naffy in Asmara, and it opened up and it produced tin fruit, chocolate, all sorts of delicacies. And of course, after all the bully beef and rubbish we'd been loaded down with right through the campaign up to this stage, it didn't stay in the naffy stores very long. But some of our chaps got very well known by the local Italian women there.
In what way?
Well, they'd been on a starvation diet as well. And I think a lot of the fellas took pity on the children more than anything else. I remember walking through the town and I had a small tin of peaches, I think it was cling peaches. And I was sort of tossing it up and down in my hand, walking along. And a woman spoke to me, a young girl spoke to me. And I don't know what she said. But I realised that she was only talking about something one needs, so I give her the tin of peaches. I thought her need was greater than mine. I could always go back and get some more anyway. But then she grabbed hold of my hand and wanted me to go somewhere with her. I don't know where it was. But eventually, I seen her and her family over the other side of the road. It was a terrific wide road, the main street in Asmara. Wonderful town. And the family came over and started giving me big slams and that, all over this little tin of peaches. Oh, my good gracious me. But some of our chaps I know were supplying them with tins of bully and things like that because they were complaining to them and what little Italian we'd learnt and picked up. We found that they'd been on a starvation diet the whole time that their forces had been in the town. They'd given them nothing. They couldn't get any food from anywhere, only from what they could produce or what they could scrounge. And a lot of this went on until eventually Naffy sort of got wise to it, I think, and they then started curtailing the issues. So you could have one tin of this and one tin of that, or one bar of that, one bar of chocolate, or one bar of something else, or boiled sweets. But, you know, you use it yourself and you saw the little kids looking at you so pathetically and helplessly that you sort of gave them, you know, you felt sorry for them more than anything else. But I'd say after 3 weeks, we got orders to move, and our next jump was to Massawa, the port. Well, we got down to this place and we dropped in action again, right by the road, right out in the open. Didn't bother to camouflage a lot because we knew that they wouldn't worry us. The Italian Air Force now was nil. We hadn't seen any Italian Air Force for a long time. And we just dropped in action there. And on our right was a light AK-AK gun upon a little bit of a mound beside us. And we've fired a few targets. I know on one occasion we were firing on a Swedish mission that was supposed to have been harbouring a machine gun units or something in the town. And Captain White, our OP officer, he'd decided that we ought to get them moving, so we shelled the mission and got them out of there. The funny thing was, as soon as you shelled something, the white flag would shoot out the window. You drop a couple of rounds and that was it. Out come with a white flag, and of course it was just too easy. But well, a couple of days there, and we were doing a shoot one day at extreme range. We were firing about 23,000 yards, 24,000 yards, something like that. And I wondered, well, what the devil's he doing? You get a switch, right, 30 minutes. You do that. Then he'd say fire, and you'd fire that round. Then he'd say left, 30 minutes, which meant you went back a degree the other way. And then he would increase your range, or you shorten your range, 50 yards, 100 yards, or you kept wondering what was going on with it. This is not the kind of shoot that we normally have. Whatever is he doing? And it went on for about an hour. Then all of a sudden we got stop. And I phoned back to the gun position. I said, what the hell are we doing here? Any idea? He said, no, I don't, not yet. He said, I'll let you know as soon as you get there. I'll connect you up. Well, presently it came back over to Tannoy from Esmond White at the OP in Massawa, that he just had an Italian battleship surrender to a 25-pounder gunfire, and our gun had been the gun that had been doing it. We thought that was terrific. He was dropping 25-pounder AP shots on the, not armor piece, HE with cap on, on the decks of this ship until eventually he hoisted the white flag. No, I never knew anything so funny in all my natural. We couldn't make out why we kept getting all these little switches and little ranges. Apparently the boat was moving about in the harbour trying to get out.
So it was your gun that did it?
It was our gun that was doing it, yeah.
Did you actually go into Massawa?
No, we didn't. We didn't go into Massawa at all. We went from Massawa straight down to Ambalalaga, then hell of a journey. I think it took us about a day to get down there.
Can you describe what happened in as much detail as you can recollect?
Well, when we got down to Ambalalaga, it was quite a long stretch from Massawa. The distance, I just can't remember, but I would think it was somewhere within about 150 mile. I might be wrong, but I'm almost sure it must have been that far. It took us a hell of a time to get there. Having arrived there, we dropped in gun position on top of a, not on top of a hill, but on a plateau that was higher up than the road or anything. And we were firing away at this place, Ambalalaga. And Ambalalaga, on top of it, is a church or something. And this was the place where in 1935-36, the Italian had used gas on the Ethiopians. Well, of course, when we knew about that, we were all sort of, we'll give them gas. We've got gas shells too, but we never used them. But whenever anything took place on top of that hill, so whenever it moved, it got fired at. You know, it never had any rest. Well, we knew that the Duke of Aosta was down there. He was the big man over the whole of Italian East Africa. He was, to them, what our viceroy was to India, you know. I think they referred to him as a viceroy of Ethiopia or East Africa or something like that, anyway. And we carried on, as I say, firing him. But one point of interest, and I think it's rather funny, this one. We had a chap with us called Galately. He wasn't a gun number. He was an ammunition number way back down the line. And we hadn't seen any fresh meat for a long, long time. And Galately decided that he would shoot a cow. So he shot a cow, which turned out to be a holy cow. And, of course, the villagers come in creating merry stink about it. But Galately got weighed off, got court-martialed in the field, one day's field punishment for shooting a sacred cow. And he had to dig a 24-by-24 gun pit for his punishment in one day. Well, we felt sorry for Galately, but even so, that cow, Yorkie Gill, number 3 gun, he was an ex-butcher in Civvy Street before he joined the army, strung this thing up between a couple of trees on drag ropes, gutted it, cut it up in pieces, and the gun position lived on boiled beef for days. And we hadn't had boiled beef, we hadn't any fresh meat for ages. My God, that was great, that meat. We enjoyed it, so did Galately, but he had to pay for it. But after when the campaign finished, we got weighed off to go down to the road at the bottom of Ambalalaga, and it come down zigzag all the way down the hill, and it landed at the bottom, and we got down there, and our job was to see that the troops that were coming down from the hill at the surrender got rid of all their arms and ammunition. Well, you've never seen such a load of queer people in all your natural. There was Air Force blokes, there was Naval blokes, there was infantry blokes, there was what do you call them, the Bergzaleli, their mountain troops. There was all sorts of Army, Navy, Air Force, a lot, all mixed up. They'd all been fighting this sort of campaign, been driven back down there after Karen and Massawa. They'd all fled down here, hoping they would be safe. But, of course, they couldn't get any farther because Cunningham, General Cunningham, was coming up with a South African division from the south, and we were coming down from the north, so they were in a pincher. They couldn't get anywhere. Of course, the old Duke decided he'd had enough and pack up. And this disarmament parade went on all through the day. and they just come down and throw their rifles down and their ammunition or machine guns and that, just dump them all down there. And the officers we had a bit of trouble with, they didn't particularly want to get rid of their pistols in a lot of cases, but they did. They had to get rid of them. We made them throw them all down. And then, I well remember there was, no, HLI was the jocks we had with us. Hell's Last Issue, as we called them. They were on guard there. And I think it was the Worcesters, I'm not sure. Anyway, they were doing a guard of honour for the Duke of Aosta when he came down and surrendered. And he came down and handed over to General Heath. And he took his surrender there. And he was taken to captivity, of which I later hear he died down in British Somaliland. I believe his trouble was consumption. He was a terrible tall man and as thin as a rake. Oh, there was nothing of him. But he was a big man, big tall man, you know. And then we sort of saw him off. Well, then after that, having got all this arms and that there, we didn't know what was going to happen. If somebody would pick him up eventually, take him away. But I remember we got in the vehicles and we went up round the area where they went. And here again, they had cut themselves into the rock face of the hills, and they were like big barrack rooms and storerooms. And the provisions they had there was simply amazing. Jam, I never seen so much jam in all my naturals they had stored away up there. They could have lived up there for another 3 years at least. And all the necessary tin foods that they had, and not any of it had been sort of cannibalized or hurt in any way. I know I loaded our gun up with a load of jams and tin fruit and tin meat, hams and what have we, so that we had some spare food to fall back on if ever we get caught again. But, however, it all came to an end there, and we moved back then, back up into Eritrea, into a place called Dekamir. And it was at Dekamir that we had the big parade for the presentation of the MC to Esmond White, the DCM to WO2 Cheeseman, the two MMs to Moore and Macmillan. I don't know, somebody else got an award and I can't remember who it was. Was it? No, I think that's right. And it was from this place that I was to be called back, sent back up to Cairo, and from Cairo to eventually come back to the UK. Having done over 6 years on foreign service, they said I was due for repat. So I came up to the RA base depot at Heliopolis, just outside of Cairo. It's a suburb of Cairo, actually. And I waited there for 2 or 3 weeks and picked up a gunner along with me, and we eventually got on the New Mauritania, went down to South Africa, Durban. Oh, that's a great place that was. We waited down there for 3 weeks or a little more. Then we got on a ship called the Tuscania. And down below, in the hold, we had 1,000 Italian prisoners to bring home with us. And from there, we went round to Cape Town. We stayed a week in Cape Town. We then went up to Trinidad, pulled up outside of Trinidad. We didn't stop. We just docked there, dropped anchor there. And from Trinidad, we went to Nova Scotia. And can you imagine how a fella felt after 6 years in hot tropical countries coming into Nova Scotia with about 6 inches of snow on the ground? Well, I was never so cold nor my natural. Absolute agony it was. But the Red Cross came on the boat and they brought on these Red Cross goodies, as we would call them, pullovers, balaclavas, gloves, socks, you know, all the hand-knitted stuff, very nice stuff. And I was fortunate enough to win a roll-neck pullover. And I wore that blooming thing all the way home from there. Because, you see, when you've been overseas for so long, your blood gets so thin that when you come to cold countries, you just can't face it. Oh, it was fantastic, it was. But we had a few days out, but unfortunately, again, you could only go out every other day because I'd be in charge of a guard today and Sergeant Parker would be in charge of a guard tomorrow on the Italian prisoners that were down in the hold. And, of course, they had to be brought up every day and allowed to exercise round the boat. God, that place stunk with them down there. Really, God, it was absolute agony.
Why was that?
Well, you know, I mean, they were all scruffy and dirty and they were not the proper convenience. This Tuscania was a Greek boat. And she wasn't equipped at all well, like any decent English boat would have been. I shouldn't have not travelled on a lot of boats, but this was an absolute thing. And they had them all in hammocks, all down on, and they were down about three floors. Well, you can imagine coming through all that hot sea area, you know, Trinidad and Durban and that. And, well, I used to get them up from down below when I was on there, get them up as often as I could. I'd have 100 up at a time, you know, and let them have a good hour's walk round and spend them down and bring another 100 up. And the captain of the ship called for me one day. He said, look, Sergeant, he said, these men are too long on the deck. I said, no, sir. I said, they got to come up. I said, we're going to kill them down there. He said, I couldn't care less. He said, they're up too long. I said, well, I said, I'm in charge of them. I said, they're coming up, sir. I'm sorry. I said, your boat. I said, but to me, I said, that's human life down there. I said, I can't leave it to die just like that. We had two or three die down there with exhaustion, you know. And it was terrible. They buried them at sea. But after that, I wouldn't keep them down there any longer now. But get as many as I could up on deck to get the fresh air and get them washed. We had showers, but they were salt seawater showers, you know. An amazing thing about these fellas, they cut you out a disc out of a metal tin, like aluminium tin, and put your name on it and show the prisoner of war camp all around it, you know. I had it for years. I don't know what happened to it. It got lost like everything else. But they were a wonderful sort of people in a way. You know, they didn't want a war. The Italian didn't want this war.
How did they behave under custody?
All right. There were no trouble at all. There weren't any trouble at all. I felt sure. I thought that when we got to Nova Scotia, we could take them out and march them around the town to give them a good exercise. But local powers wouldn't allow it, you know. We had one officer, two sergeants, myself and Sergeant Parker, two full bombardiers and about eight Lance bombardiers. And all the rest were just gunners that were all coming home because they had something gone wrong in the UK. Their parents had been bombed out. Their parents had been killed. Compassionate cases, you know, that had to come back to the UK, been sent back. And, it was a sorry state. Well, then we convoyed up there to go across the Atlantic and come in at, we landed at Gourock in Scotland. When I glad to get rid of them Tonys.
Did the Italian POWs show gratitude to you for taking them up?
Yeah, they did. They appreciate you could tell, you know, that you've done them a favour by having them up as much as possible, by giving them whatever little liberties you could. Mind, the food was good on the boat. I don't think the food was run by the crew. I believe the food was run by something military. Because, you see, when they, during the war, they equipped boats and they put staff on. Like, you'd have gunners on there that would do the gunnery side of it on private boats. I mean, civvy boats, you know. I mean, when we came over it was on this Tuscania. That's right. I had a detachment of blokes out on the back on a six-pounder. And he's a blooming great, I think it was 6-pounder or 6-inch. We used to fire smoke floats coming along, just fire these smoke floats for practice. Could never hit them blooming things because the boat's going up and down like that all the time. We weren't used to this, but because we were gunners, we could form detachments and do it, you know. And a lot of these, then we had this maritime gunnery too, that they would be on the boat, and you'd have cooking staff on the boats as well. But the food we got and the food the Italians got was very good on the boat coming over. Very good indeed.
Would you say that the East African campaign was a hard campaign or an easy campaign?
Hard, but by no means unpleasant.
In what way was it hard?
Well, the way in which you lived, you literally lived in gumpits all your time you were there. You slept very little. You were, when you got a break, you could sleep and sleep and sleep, sort of thing. But you still had your work to do. It was a hard campaign, but it wasn't all that unpleasant, really. You take the rough with the smooth. And of course, our losses in the regiment was only about 3. Captain Gordon was 1. Who else was it? Glenn Denning, I think he was killed there. But of course, my regiment suffered when it went to the cauldron. That's where it suffered. It lost everything there. We lost some good chaps there.
That's outside our scope for this thing here. But you mentioned how you were under fire at Barento. Mm. Did the Italian artillery ever have you under fire at any other time?
No, as I say, only once down at Kerem when they did put a bracket over our gun position. But apart from that, I can never remember any other fire at any time being under what we would have called counter-bombardment. Never did I experience a counter-bombardment. Never. Right way through the campaign. Because although they hit our gun position, we weren't there. And that was the only time that they ever did counter-bombard. But had we been in that gun position at the time, we wouldn't have been able to hit them back because we'd have had our heads down. So at no time can I ever remember any of our troop or any of the other troop. You see, you lost a troop. Baker would be here, Abel would be there, Don would be over there, and Charlie would be somewhere else. You see, you weren't, although you were a regiment, each troop or each battery was sort of scattered around all over the place. You didn't know where they were. You only knew that it was a troop in front of you firing. Yeah. I didn't. Able troop was to our right rear, I believe. Right, they were behind the bank. Baker troop was right by the 59th Kalo Stone, or the 49th Kalo Stone. 59. And when they got this picture done by David Shepherd, I've got a copy upstairs, they show a gun position right by the stone, and that is my gun position. I know that for a fact, and Ives Routliffe will tell you the same story, because Able troop were in our gun position before we got up to Kerem. And then they moved out and moved forward, and we come into their gun pits. You know, the first fist fill battery, you see. The two troops work together, you know, one behind each other.
You said that you didn't think much of the Italian troops, but did the Italians, in your experience, have any good units at all?
Well, they had them crack mountain troops that they were always boasting about, but from what I never saw much of them. I can't even think. You see, you don't see a lot from a gun position as to what's going on the target area, but from the old P position you do. And this is where things happen. One would be firing away and you get a message come back from the old P, or somebody would come down from the old P and they'd be talking about it. Say, you know, when you put that last round of gunfire down, you know, when you fired that last shot, good guy, said, they were knocking MITs down like as though they were 9-pins. Somebody would tell you this. You wouldn't see it, but the man up the OP would see it. But you can't, because you're doing indirect fire. You're firing up over the hills. You're firing a long way away. I mean, what can you see at, say, 8,000 yards over the top of the hills? You don't see nothing. And even on the big barrage at Kerem, which was the biggest barrage before Al Alamein, one didn't see a lot of fall or shot then, only when we were firing on Cameron Ridge, which was in front of us. You saw it then. But all the other stuff that was been was hurled up over the top, on top of the hill, just falling along the crests and all that. You could see shells falling there, because that was in view. But the point was, you never had a chance, really, to look at it, because you were too busy making sure that all your angles were right, your ranges were right. Number one's got to keep coming around, checking to see the layers all right. You've got to make sure that he's putting the round in with the right fuse. He's took the fuse cap off and what have we, or he's left the fuse cap on if it's got to be left on. See, if you left the fuse cap on a HE119 or 117, it gave a little delayed action when it hit something hard. But if you took the fuse cap off, so whenever it touched the ground, it exploded. And this was the glory of the 25-pounder shell. It never made a hole in the floor. It exploded there and blew up. And that's where it took its toll. But with the 18-pounder shell, it went down in the ground and exploded and threw up a load of rubbish. You see, they'd perfected this shell so much that sticking out the top of the shell when you took the fuse cap off was a little tiny tin cap about the size of a thimble go on your finger. Underneath that tin cap was a nail, or what appeared to look like a nail. Well, as soon as that hit the deck, it exploded the shell. But if you wanted to delay that, you left the iron cap on. Like when you're firing on hillside, you didn't want you wanted to get into the hill sort of thing, or get in and shake somebody up, or in a pillbox, you know, you wanted to get into something. That's the way you never use armor piercing shot, not for that kind of. You could use it on tank stuff, but I didn't. I never had occasion to use it. That was how it was done, and that again was another reason why the 25 pounder was such a good gun, because when its shell dropped, it exploded there. Poof, up, and it would mow a 100 yards sort of thing. Anybody within 100 yards, that was it sort of thing. They'd get a shell splinter in them, and anything within 50 yards was dead.
Were you ever in action against Italian tanks?
No, I didn't see any Italian tanks. It wasn't much use for them. We had, when I say we, the division had, as far as I know, 3 Walser Matildas. That's the old I-tank, as they called it, infantry tank. The 3 of them went up the road behind our gun position, and I think they were only brought down for special purpose to try and get over that road by shifting the shell where it had been blown up, because the machine guns couldn't penetrate the tanks. They had the skirt along the side of them covering their tracks. They were called the Walser Matilda. There again, another prehistoric weapon. It wasn't anything great. Another funny thing that happened to us too, there was an airplane come down to the valley one day, and everybody started opening up with the Vickers berth. There was a Ben gun. Started opening it, and then somebody said, "Stop at your damn voice, a hurricane." That was the first we'd ever seen of the hurricane. We were up in Cairn when we first saw a hurricane. You know, everything that happened in the UK took months before it got out to us. I know, it was hard, I suppose, but it didn't kill you with exhaustion or anything like that. You just got tired on agreement. You couldn't call it a grand war, could you? But you weren't fighting the enemy. You weren't fighting a really strong enemy.
Did the Italians use planes against you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They used to have these CR-42s come over, and I forget what their fighter plane was. And we had a Wellington bomber, a two-wing job. And it flew over the fort one day, and it must have met a shell on the way over. It just